this was the her marking the territory as her own. A bit later on, the pub acquired a nickname. It was known as the Bucket of Blood because it was the venue for prize fights. So as time goes on, we've had the neighborhood fall into decline once the theatricals move in and the respectable people move out. It becomes a place of entertainment, of theater, of boxing, prostitution. It's basically Las Vegas, isn't it, with all those things? Let's just take a look at another beautiful alley, just a short walk from the Lamb and Flag. This one's quite hard to find. You probably need a tour guide to take you there. It's here. The entrance is just here, in through there. And here's another gas lamp. This one's on in the middle of the day because we no longer have an army of thousands of lamplighters going around putting lighting and dousing the lamps. They're on automatic timers, but the timers go wrong. And sometimes if you're lucky, you'll see a gas lamp burning in the middle of the day. And then one of the few remaining lamplighters, I think we still have five of them, will eventually come round and sort the mechanism out and douse it. But on a good day, you can find a gas lamp burning in the middle of the day. Anyway, this is what it looks like at dusk. It's absolutely lovely. If it looks familiar and you haven't been in it, it's because it's the model for Diagon Alley in the Harry Potter movies, and it's been rebuilt in Leavesden Studios. A number of the other guys used to tell me, but I think they were just winding me up, that Nell Gwynn had a home in Goodwin's Court, but I don't think that can be true because it seems to have been built in 1690, and Nell Gwynn by then had been dead for 3 years. So I think the chances of her having a house here are quite limited. This is John Gay, and this is effectively his partner in crime, John Rich. Gay was a playwright, Rich was an impresario, and they put on a show, a musical actually, in the other theatre, the one that wasn't at Covent Garden, the theatre at Lincoln's Inn Fields, and that show was called The Beggar's Opera, and it was phenomenally successful. I think it premiered in 1728, and they made so much money from The Beggar's Opera that the saying was that The Beggar's Opera made Gay rich and Rich gay. But they made so much money, they were able, or Rich was able, to abandon the little theatre in Lincoln's Inn Fields and build a much bigger, grander one here at Covent Garden. It became the Royal Opera House. Of course, this isn't the one that Rich actually built, because guess what? Like everything else in London, it burnt down. But at this point, Covent Garden, from the 1730s, becomes the undisputed entertainment centre of London, because it's now got both the major theatres. And look, they are all Drury Lane Theatre, the Covent Garden Theatre, St Paul's Church, the Actors' Church, are all within just a few minutes' walk of each other. So this is now the undisputed entertainment capital of London, and we can get an idea of what it was like in the middle of the 18th century, so 100 years after Nell Gwynn and Charles II, by reading the journals of this gentleman. Again, do you all recognise who this is? I'll tell you. This is James Boswell. James Boswell was a Scottish lawyer who liked to travel. One of the places he liked to travel to was London. And when he was in London, he mixed in literary circles and became friendly with the greatest literary giant of the middle to late 18th century, Samuel Johnson. And the thing that Boswell is most famous for is his great biography of Dr. Johnson. But he kept a diary, like Samuel Pepys. The diary actually lay undiscovered until the 20th century, when bits of it turned up. They've all been acquired by the University of Yale in America. And Yale is gradually releasing bits of Boswell's diary or journal, as he called it. And we can get a flavour of what Covent Garden was like in the 1760s from the journal entries that Boswell made when he came here in the winter of 1762 and spring of 1763. So he says that, "I've now been in London several weeks without ever enjoying the delightful sex, although I'm surrounded with numbers of free-hearted ladies of all kinds, from the splendid madam at 50 guineas a night, down to the civil nymph with white thread stockings who tramps along the strand and will resign her engaging person to your honour for a pint of wine and a shilling. So let's put those amounts of money in context. 50 guineas, so little over £50 in those days, is now about £6,000, £10,000, and a shilling, or a 20th of a pound, is now about £10. So that's the price range. But Boswell really didn't want to use that way of enjoying the delightful sex. What he does is he hopes to be more successful. In this view, I had now called several times for a handsome actress of Covent Garden Theatre, whom I was a little acquainted with, and whom I shall distinguish in this my journal by the name of Louisa. Now, Boswell becomes convinced that the relationship he's having with Louisa isn't a transactional one. Although he is giving her money, those are just gifts, that they are in love with each other. He's faithful to her, and she's faithful to him, which is why he gets a shock to discover that he was with his surgeon this morning, who's declared that he's got an infection and that the lady whom he got it from couldn't have been ignorant of it. So he's heartbroken. He breaks off the relationship with her, and he then has to deal with the infection that he got, which was almost certainly syphilis or gonorrhea. And takes him a few weeks, but he's back on the streets in May. What does he say in May? He says, "I then sallied forth to the piazza, in rich flow of animal spirits and burning with fierce desire. I met two very pretty little girls who asked me to take them with me. My dear girls, I said, I am a poor fellow. I can give you no money, but if you choose to have a glass of wine and my company and let us be gay and obliging to each other without money, I am your man. We were shown into a good room and had a bottle of sherry before us in a minute. I toyed with them and drank about and sung Youth the Season and thought myself Captain McKeith." McKeith is the anti-hero of the Beggar's Opera, still popular in the 1760s, 40 years after its premiere. He says, "I then solaced my existence with them, one after the other, according to their seniority." Not sure what that means. Is it the oldest one first or the youngest one first? "I was quite raised, as the phrase is. Thought I was in a London tavern, the Shakespeare's Head, enjoying high debauchery after my sober winter. I parted with my ladies politely and came home in a glow of spirits." So I like to think that this is the origin of the expression wine, women, and song. It is all in this one diary entry. There's the wine, there's the bottle of sherry, there's the two women, and he sang for them. But I don't want to give you the impression that the sex trade in Covent Garden was all just fun and games. I mean, somebody did try to give you that impression. This is a book that was a bestseller in the middle of the 18th century, a little bit earlier than Samuel Johnson. First published in 1748, Memoirs of a Woman of Pleasure. We probably know it better by the name of the woman whose words it is supposed to be, Fanny Hill. And it describes the life of a woman of pleasure in Covent Garden, a prostitute, a serial mistress, and it is all fun and games. The only thing is, it isn't by a woman. Fanny Hill is a character of fiction. It's a male fantasy by a man called John Cleland. And the truth is actually a lot less pleasant. And to get a picture of what it was really like, we can look at the work of the foremost artist of the early to middle part of the 18th century. This is William Hogarth. William Hogarth actually lived for a time in Covent Garden, and he made paintings and engravings that satirized and exemplified, you know, the true state of things. I mean, the sex trade was a sort of pyramid. Yes, at the top, there were a few very successful and rich and happy courtesans. And then in the middle, there were the girls who worked in the, they called them bathhouses, but they were just whorehouses in Covent Garden. And at the bottom were the street whores, you know, the shilling a shilling and a pint of wine people. At one time, it was said, estimated in the 18th century, that 20%, one in five of all women living in London, made all or part of their money out of the sex trade. And it was a pretty high risk trade. And Hogarth illustrates this in a series of engravings. There were paintings as well, but they got lost in a fire. This is England. But the engravings are still around, which he entitled The Harlot's Progress. So that's where we get the title from. And The Harlot's Progress tells the story of this innocent girl who comes to London from the country. She's seduced into the trade by a madam. For a while, she's doing reasonably well. She has a rich lover, but eventually she falls down the greasy pole and ends up dying of syphilis at the age of 23. And really, that's what it was like for the majority, I think. And the cure, by the way, for sexually transmitted diseases in those days was mercury. So some of them, those who survived the disease, might be killed by the cure. In fact, there was a saying at the time, one night with Venus, a lifetime with mercury. Just to be complete, the sex trade in London, centred on Covent Garden, wasn't just for the heterosexual market. There was a very vibrant gay and transgender scene, and there were establishments known as molly houses, which were essentially gay bars where men could meet other men. But from time to time, the authorities would decide to crack down on the sex trade in Covent Garden. As far as the girls were concerned, that might mean a spell in jail or a fine. For the men, it was much more serious. So there was a raid in 1726 where Molly Clapp, who was the keeper of one of these notorious molly houses, was made to stand in the pillory for running essentially a gay bar. But that's nothing compared to what happened to some of the customers who were executed because sodomy, when they could be bothered to enforce the law, which quite often wasn't very often, carried a death sentence.